I think they should use the word legal. Legal votes. They're trying to steal an election. They're trying to rig an election.
The president can sue a ham sandwich. He can send 1,000 lawyers.
We have a lot of information coming and litigation that you'll see.
No collusion. There's no collusion after all of that, which makes me perhaps the most innocent man anywhere in the history of the United States.
Winning is easy. Losing is never easy. Not for me, it's not.
Come on. Don't be ridiculous. Networks don't get to decide elections. Courts do.
This is Josh Barrow, host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers, the podcast about all of President Trump's legal issues. And Ken White is with me. Ken is my co-host, a criminal defense attorney, and former federal prosecutor. He writes the Pope Hat Report, which you can subscribe to on Substack. Hello, Ken.
Hello, Josh. Welcome back. If anything's broken, it was like that when I found it.
There has been some tension this week among the president's legal team, or at least among people who purport to be the president's legal team. The campaign, the Trump campaign, put out a statement saying that Sidney Powell, who listeners to this show will recall as Michael Flynn's bombastic lawyer, saying she does not represent the campaign, nor does she represent the president in his personal capacity. She is practicing law on her own, the campaign says. Now, just days ago, Powell appeared at a press conference with Rudy Giuliani, where she alleged a wide conspiracy by Hugo Chavez, who I will note has been dead for 7 years, to use voting machines to change votes away from Donald Trump toward Joe Biden. Later in the week, she alleged that Georgia Republican Governor Brian Kemp had been bribed by communists to allow Joe Biden to win his state. This allegation, along with the Trump team's bruising loss in a Pennsylvania federal court, seems to have been a bridge too far for the president, who had his other lawyers cut this lawyer loose. So, Ken, this statement from the Trump campaign saying Sidney Powell is, quote, practicing law on her own, unquote. What does that even mean? Doesn't a lawyer have to have a client? Is the idea that she's representing herself? How can you practice law on your own?
Well, Josh, under typical circumstances, whether or not you represent someone is not quite such a philosophical question. It's actually a legal one, usually governed by things like retainer agreements and appearances on someone's behalf and that type of thing. The Trump statement was vague, and notably vague, because you'd have to notice it didn't say that she was never their lawyer, that she never was part of the legal team. Instead, it just said she isn't now. And this was complicated when Powell, shortly before we recorded this, released a statement of her own saying, that's right, there was never a retainer agreement, they never paid me, I am not their attorney. And then went on to a digression about communists from Serbia undermining the vote. And
Serbia?
Serbia. Also Hong Kong.
That's a new one, right?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's safe to say that is new, Josh. And also something about a Kraken being on steroids. And frankly, I was laughing too hard to keep reading at that point. But they are being very vague about whether she ever had any sort of legal role. But it's very clear that now they're saying she does not. So it's not clear what standing she does have other than this sort of free-floating crusader for truth, justice, and opposition to the Serbs, I suppose. And this could create some interesting problems later when people start asking, well, when was she a lawyer for them? And can we get a look at any of her communications with the Trump team? Because if she wasn't anyone's lawyer, then those communications are not attorney-client privileged.
Would that end up mattering in practice here? I mean, if you would have to have a subpoena or something for those communications. Is there any reason that there would be an investigation that would uncover the president's communications with Sidney Powell to the extent that she was not his attorney?
Well, I suppose only if there is some sort of inquiry into this whole hot mess of how this litigation unfolded, which hopefully there won't be because it would be ridiculous and counterproductive. But it's just not a good way to run a railroad, Josh, to get up on the podium and present yourself as a part of a legal team and then later in a series of vague statements from both sides say you're not part of the legal team. It just invites trouble.
Well, so among the other signs that Sidney Powell was maybe not ever the president's lawyer, she never appeared on his behalf in court in the way that Rudy Giuliani did, which we will discuss in a moment. And so if your role as a lawyer is basically to be a glorified public relations person, we've seen a lot of that over the last few years, does that carry any of the professional responsibilities associated with being a lawyer and being a member of the bar? I mean, both Powell and Giuliani have made statements in these press conferences that are wild lies. In some cases, as we'll discuss in a moment, I think defamatory toward a number of people and entities. Is that an ethical violation? Can you be disbarred for conduct that doesn't happen in court, but that happens at a press conference?
Well, that's a good question. Normally, attorney-client services relate to law and legal advice and not to other types of advice like business advice or public relations advice. But here, I think it's likely that if there were ever any sort of bar inquiry, that what Powell and Giuliani have been doing is so intertwined with the legal things that the Trump campaign are doing, that it would be very difficult for them to argue that they're not acting in a legal capacity. That said, it's very rare for the various state bars to really take action about this type of thing, about what I'll call, you know, general public dipshit. As opposed to things being done specific in court. So the state bars remain a poor avenue to police this particular type of bad behavior. They have their hands full just with people ripping off client trust accounts and bad behavior actually in court.
So one thing that occurs to me in terms of a reason that we could eventually have discovery of some of the communications among these people is if there were to be a defamation suit. Now, if you were Dominion Voting Systems, which has been falsely accused of being at the center of some Venezuelan communist conspiracy to steal the election, it's quite conceivable that that is damaging to Dominion's business interests as a vendor of voting machines to governments. They've been both accused of this serious criminal activity and placed at the center of a political controversy that might discourage procurement officers and election offices around the country or maybe even around the world from buying their equipment. Couldn't they sue all these people for defamation? And wouldn't they actually have a pretty strong claim compared to some of the other defamation claims that we've discussed here, where, you know, the statement is obviously and laughably false, the set of statements that have been made about Dominion, and quite obviously damaging to Dominion's financial interests?
I think they probably do have a good defamation case because these people, Giuliani and Powell and all these people, have been making provably false statements of fact about them, despite very strong indications that they're false. This is kind of classic actual malice, where you're ignoring huge big signs that what you're saying is absolutely not true. Under normal circumstances, you would say it doesn't make sense to sue because then you're just giving the whole issue more attention, that, you know, you don't get in a fight with a lunatic in a defamation case. For Dominion, though, they may have no choice, in effect. They have to take some avenue to try to clear their name, because I think right now they are going to be fairly radioactive, not for any rational reason, but just because of the crazies who believe anything. The sort of QAnon contingent are going to be outraged if they're hired any place, and will, you know, primary any politician who agrees to using them in the state, and for no good reason, for no rational reason, I think it's going to be very difficult for them to get hired.
And so presumably, if Dominion were to sue Powell and Giuliani, one of the questions, they would also want to sue the president. Now, the president has made various statements on Twitter, but wouldn't one of the questions be whether the president directed any of his associates to make these statements about Dominion? And so then, if that was part of that lawsuit, would it matter if the communications were privileged? Is that one of the situations where you can pierce the attorney-client privilege if the attorney and the client are working together to make defamatory statements about some third party?
No, that doesn't necessarily pierce the attorney-client privilege, just that you're working together, unless it's a crime or a fraud. So you might be kind of alluding to the crime-fraud exception, where something is not privileged if you go to a lawyer for the purposes of helping commit a crime or a fraud. But just in generalized defamation, that's not an exception to the privilege. However, if Powell was not representing anybody, if she was just an interloper there, then having her in the loop could defeat the privilege, unless they say that she was in effect the Trump whisperer, that they needed her in order to communicate with the client, or the real lawyers in the case to be able to interact. Her services were needed, and that talking to her and having her in the loop was part of the process of rendering legal advice to the president, which is not an argument I'd want to have to make, but it's not as stupid as some of the other arguments they're making. I'll put it that way.
Let's talk about some of the actual legal proceedings, because an ongoing theme has been Trump representatives making claims on television and other public forums that they're unwilling to actually make in court, where it would be perjury to make false claims. And so Rudy Giuliani, who has been alleging this wide conspiracy, also argued a case in a federal court in Pennsylvania, making a much more narrow set of claims and not alleging some widespread fraud in the state of Pennsylvania, actually not alleging a fraud at all, just saying that because there were different rules in different counties about how mail-in ballots that had some problems with the way that they were put together, that had different rules about how those were handled, that created an equal protection problem for certain voters. So they had this very narrow argument, and it still was not an argument that at all impressed federal judge Matthew Brand.
It was never a good argument, and Giuliani's involvement made it substantially worse. I listened to the entire oral argument, which I deserve because I've done things, and it was really a travesty on a level that's difficult for lawyers to explain to non-lawyers. The things that Rudy Giuliani didn't understand when the judge was asking him questions, he did not understand the fundamental building blocks of the constitutional analysis on the claims he was making. And it was painfully obvious when the judge was asking him questions, trying to get him to articulate those arguments. And the judge was very kindly and professionally, the way a good judge will, kind of walking him through them, and he still didn't understand it. It was one of the most embarrassing performances by a lawyer I've ever seen. And it was in, if you believe their narrative, one of the most important cases that's ever been brought in America. So the judge's subsequent order dismissing it was not as harsh as it could have been, but harsh, and basically demolished the entire pretense that they had any standing to bring these claims, that the claims had any legal merit, or that the remedies they were asking for had any logical connection to the wrongs they were complaining about.
Yeah, so the Trump campaign was here along with two individual voters who were plaintiffs, and their argument was basically they had tried to vote by mail and their votes had been rejected. In one case, it was because the voter had failed to put his ballot in the required privacy envelope inside the outer envelope in the somewhat complex system that Pennsylvania has for the return of mail ballots. And so some more heavily Democratic counties had a system where they were able to see, I guess by holding the ballot up to the light or something, you could see that there was no privacy envelope, and they would contact voters and be like, you have to fix your ballot if you want us to count it. And a handful of voters in the state did this. But there were other counties, more Republican-leaning counties, that made no such effort. And so this guy's ballot got thrown out. And so his argument was basically, my right to vote was abridged. But he didn't sue the county that rejected his ballot. He sued some other county that had a more permissive structure that would have counted somebody else's ballot. And that's not the way this works, right? You have to sue the person who actually did the wrong that you're suing over.
Right. So he didn't sue the right people. He didn't sue the people who prevented him from fixing his ballot. But more importantly, what the judge points out is the remedy makes no sense. So that he said that the remedy for him not getting to fix his ballot was to throw out all the votes from the counties where people did get to fix ballots, even if those particular people didn't. And that remedy makes no sense whatsoever and obviously disenfranchises a huge group of people. And that was what the judge was particularly brutal about, and I think rightly so. It's an outrageous argument. And as the judge said, if someone's making such a sweeping, outrageous argument, you would expect to see some sort of legal or factual support for it, and there just wasn't.
So this lawsuit has been dismissed with prejudice. MSNBC legal analyst Glenn Kirshner says in all his years as a federal prosecutor, he doesn't think he ever saw a case dismissed with prejudice. So this is a remarkable rebuke to the Trump campaign.
Oh, for God's sake. Well, this is why you should be careful listening to former federal prosecutors, present company included. that's not what with prejudice means. I mean, you also see people online saying, oh my gosh, with prejudice, that means the judge admits they're biased. All that with prejudice means is that a case is dismissed and that the case is now final in the trial court. There are going to be no more amendments. You can't rebring the same claim in the court. The only thing now to do is to appeal. So, in fact, it happens in every single civil case eventually that it's ended with prejudice, dismissed, or whatever happens. It's completely routine. And also, as he should know, happens in criminal cases. In fact, you might remember that's the issue we've been talking about in the Michael Flynn case, whether or not if long-suffering federal Judge Sullivan dismisses the charges, as the Justice Department is suggesting, whether he does it with or without prejudice, that is, whether or not the Biden administration could refile. So he's all wet on that one.
As you know, you can't appeal a decision to dismiss a case with prejudice. You can't just go and refile it again in the trial court, but you can go to the appellate court and say this shouldn't have been dismissed. So I guess they're doing that, and the stated strategy from the Trump legal team, such as it is now without Sidney Powell, is that they want to get to the Supreme Court, which will then give them the right ruling on this, even though the trial judge didn't go their way. So I guess this is just one more brick in the road.
Yeah, but the road has turned it to head it directly over a cliff. So it would have been difficult for me to imagine how they could make things worse on appeal than they had in the trial court. But they've done it. They've pulled it off. And here's what they've done. So they wanted to amend the complaint again, and they wanted to amend it to resurrect a due process claim that they had dismissed. So when Rudy Giuliani showed up at this hearing, what he said was, you know, we think these arguments are right, but also we want to file a new complaint because we accidentally dismissed something we shouldn't have dismissed, which, let me just say, is not the most credibility-enhancing argument that you're ever going to make. So the judge said, when he issued his ruling, he said, you're wrong on all these points, and also, no, you're not going to amend to resurrect the claim that you dismissed. So now they've appealed. And what they're saying is the only thing we're appealing is the judge's refusal to let us amend to resurrect that claim. And here's the problem. By doing that, they are arguably giving up any argument that the judge was wrong on any of the points he ruled on. And all those points are essential to even this stupid thing that they dismissed that they want to revive. So they are, in effect, giving up, waiving the key arguments that they need to prevail on anything. And they are narrowing down the scope of the appeal that they could hypothetically take all the way to the Supreme Court to one really narrow, silly issue that will not be determinative of the outcome. I find it difficult to imagine how you could do a worse job of strategy in appealing from this. And it is just inexplicable. I keep looking for other people who do appellate law to explain, you know, what fourth dimensional chess is behind this, and there isn't any. It's just absolutely crazy.
Is Rudy Giuliani a good lawyer?
No. No, God, no. I mean, the man appeared apparently for the first in court for the first time in 28 years, and it showed. He's a showman. He's suitable for, you know, spouting things and not getting hard questions on Fox News or, I suppose, these days Newsmax. But he was woefully unprepared. If you did that performance at a moot court at a fourth-rate law school, you would get an F.
So you would not pay $20,000 a day for his legal services?
Well, I don't know. If I had a lot of money and a really serious kink for watching people I didn't like humiliate themselves in public, I could see possibly doing it. But for actual legal services—
You already have one of those things, right, Ken?
So, but no, I would not. I would not pay any amount of money. I would pay a significant amount of money for Rudy Giuliani not to be representing me.
Because that was the news report, was that he came to the president of the campaign and said, I want $20,000 a day for this. Now, all along, Rudy's been representing the president for free. And it's been basically a loss leader for his business, as far as I can tell, that, you know, other clients he might sign up like the access that he has to the president. And so he might as well represent the president for free. But given that the president is about to leave office, it's not obvious that he's a good loss leader anymore. And so it would make sense that Rudy would therefore seek direct payment for whatever it is that he does for a living, although it's not clear to me that he's getting that money out of the president anytime soon.
Well, look, Rudy Giuliani's performance will help him make money by talking to the sort of people who like this type of thing. So he has a good career ahead, you know, talking to people who thinks that there's a satanic sex conspiracy involving pizza places. And that's his circuit now. And he can go out and talk to those people and make money doing it. And people will probably hire him to do crazy public things if they want to play to that segment of the Trump base. But is anyone going to hire him to do serious legal things? Absolutely not.
Did he used to be a good lawyer? Because it's amazing to me how many completely shitty former federal prosecutors we have been seeing over the last few years, with Giuliani obviously as the index case. But Sidney Powell was a federal prosecutor. That MSNBC analyst with the dumbass line about the dismissal with prejudice, he was a federal prosecutor. Are these offices just full of morons waiting to leave federal service and go embarrass themselves in some other capacity?
This hurts, Josh. This really sincerely hurts. The answer is there is a huge cachet to being a former federal prosecutor, and sometimes it's earned and sometimes it's not. A lot of people discover when they leave the prosecutor's office, whether state or federal, that when they were winning a lot, maybe they were winning a lot because they were vastly overpowering the other side and the deck was stacked heavily in their favor. Also, I just don't think you can ignore the crazy factor here, that these are not people playing really to the court. They're playing to the crowd. And so when they play to the crowd, that naturally involves them doing absolutely crazy, stupid things in court that anyone would recognize as bad lawyering. But you would also have to see is exactly the sort of thing that riles up Newsmax type audience.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we can talk about Michael Flynn. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers. This is Josh Barrow, and I'm back with attorney Ken White on All the President's Lawyers. So Sidney Powell is not Donald Trump's lawyer. Maybe she never was Donald Trump's lawyer. We're not sure, but she's definitely Michael Flynn's lawyer. And the question of whether to grant the government's motion to dismiss the false statement charge to which Flynn had already pleaded guilty remains before long-suffering federal judge Emmett Sullivan. Ken, where does this case stand? We thought Sullivan would have ruled by now.
I imagine Sullivan's, you know, kicking back, eating popcorn, watching this show like the rest of us, but maybe he's crafting a very careful order, and certainly he gave up any attempt to release it in time to have any influence over the election, which arguably is the right thing to do for a judge who shouldn't be influencing elections, and I'm sure he's going to come out with it, and I suspect it's going to be extremely thorough.
Because there's this ticking clock here, which has to do with the president being scheduled to leave office on January 20th. Now, conceivably, if Sullivan didn't rule before then, could the government come in and withdraw this motion and then try to proceed with the trial? And then similarly, this all could be preempted by a pardon from the president for Michael Flynn, which I would have told you a few days ago was likely. I don't know if the president being furious with his lawyer, Sidney Powell, changes that calculus. But you would think that if you were Judge Sullivan, you would want to get your order out there so it would at least be on the record. Because if there's a pardon, doesn't all of this become moot and then there's not even a reason to issue the order?
Yes, that's true. If there's a pardon, then the whole thing becomes moot and there's really no logical basis for Judge Sullivan to issue an order laying out what he thinks happened and why it's important. But I don't think there's any reason to think that Trump is going to rush the more outrageous pardons. I suspect he'll do it at the last minute, the way presidents have tended to do with these types of highly controversial pardons. in theory, if Sullivan held on to the order and waited and Biden took office and Trump hadn't done anything, then the Department of Justice could just reverse itself for the second time. And I'm sure he'd have things to say about that, too. And then it would just proceed with sentencing, since Flynn has pled guilty and is awaiting sentencing. Yeah, I think you're right that the interesting question now is, how does this whole thing with Powell play into Trump's feelings about whether or not there should be a pardon? Trump, of course, is extremely transactional, and if he's mad at Powell, and it's not clear whether or not he is, you could see that having an impact on whether or not that he really wants to do this pardon for the client of someone that he's now mad at.
The Flynn prosecution is one item, but there are a number of things that may be ongoing in DOJ, in the Southern District of New York, and other places, investigations relevant to Trump and his associates, either that are proceeding or that maybe haven't been proceeding because of decisions made within that Justice Department. Ordinarily, they don't tell us what's going on with an investigation unless they're going to be bringing indictments in the investigation. And then you also have these investigations conducted by the Manhattan DA and other New York State-related entities. There's been some news suggesting that they're looking at payments to Ivanka Trump that were classified as consulting payments. What is the situation for this, given that, you know, the president is going to be leaving office in a couple of months? Joe Biden, I guess, will have some decisions to make about how to proceed with this, but he doesn't really have to make those decisions, right? He can just say, I'm not going to involve myself at all, let DOJ do or not do whatever it's going to do, and then Manhattan DA is entirely independent.
That's right. There've been a couple of somewhat hand-wringing articles suggesting that Biden is not going to pursue Trump. But when you drill down into it, what they really say is that he said that really he's going to restore a normal relationship with the Department of Justice, where he doesn't tell them what to do and he trusts them to do appropriate things within their purview. And so he's not going to make an agenda item for him to push for Department of Justice to go after anyone in particular, which will be, you know, a refreshing return to some sort of normality. And absolutely, you're right. He doesn't have any sway over the Manhattan DA's office. And, you know, we got this the story in the New York Times this past week suggesting that they are ramping up their investigation of allegedly bogus tax deductions connected to Ivanka Trump. So that could well be moving someplace.
Why would it matter if the payments to Ivanka were excessive? I mean, if they paid out of the business and created a business expense, that would create business income on Ivanka's side of the ledger. So I don't see how that would necessarily be a way to evade taxes. What is the legal concern there?
Well, again, Trump's tax picture is, shall we say, not entirely clear. But if it's basically a way to transfer money from Trump to Ivanka, then it could be evading gift taxes. It could be evading all sorts of other limitations on transfers. Ivanka might be taxed differently at different rates than Trump is. And, you know, if it's something that is involves false statements about the nature of the payments, and that itself can be criminal. So there's a variety of ways that it's really hard to analyze when we don't have the baseline of knowing what Trump's tax picture is to begin with.
One thing we know the Manhattan DA has been looking for is the president's financial records from his accountants at Mazars LLP. And one thing we've discussed a few times is that it's not likely that they're looking for the tax returns themselves. They should have those already from governmental authorities. What they want is communications or drafts or other things that would indicate how certain things that are on Trump entities' tax returns, how those got to be on the tax returns, who had knowledge of them, who made decisions, because that would be relevant in a criminal tax case, you know, whether you knew that the thing you were doing was something that you weren't supposed to do. Where does that stand? Because that got up to the Supreme Court, which said that the president has no special privileges against discovery of those records as president, but he can pursue the normal claims that any person would if they wanted to quash a subpoena. And so that's been working its way through the courts again. I guess because it doesn't regard special privileges of the president, whatever the president's arguing there, he can continue to argue even after he's left office?
Yes, because he's going to be judged on the same basis as anybody else. That's going to continue to wind through the courts with those arguments, which for the most part have been rejected.
And then E. Jean Carroll, this is another piece of litigation that I think is affected by whether the president is in office or not. Remember, E. Jean Carroll alleges that the president raped her at the Bergdorf Goodman department store in Manhattan in the 1990s. He denied this claim in extremely coarse and insulting terms. She sued him for defamation, saying that he defamed her by accusing her of lying about this. And so the government had sought to step into Trump's shoes in this case. They got an unfavorable ruling on that from a federal judge. How is that going to proceed, given that that's something the Biden DOJ will end up presiding over? So can that is the president going to have to defend that defamation suit in court as, in his individual capacity?
Well, he is. And the interesting thing will be, I mean, the federal judge in this has just scolded the Department of Justice and say, you don't represent the president. I found that you don't represent the president. So, you know, stop pretending on the docket that you do, which does not bode well for how things are going to go for the president in the remainder of the case. But I mean, once Biden takes office, the Department of Justice is probably no longer going to be making this argument or appealing that ruling by the judge or pushing this argument. I say probably because I mean, even if the argument seems outrageous, the Department of Justice has an institutional interest in having broad discretion to decide whether or not it steps in to defend federal officers from these types of lawsuits. And there may be institutional issues in the arguments that are in play. For instance, whether or not this statute applies to the president at all, that will have them continue to litigate it, as incredibly unpopular as that would be.
But couldn't they just decline to appeal the ruling in this case and then reserve the option to appeal later when there's a set of facts that's more sympathetic? If they don't appeal this, that's not establishing national precedent that the Department of Justice can't step in a similar case in the future, right?
It's not establishing it the way it would if you had a ruling from a court of appeal or the Supreme Court, but it will definitely have weight and influence future judges deciding the issue. So, you know, it's possible they will decide that's an important enough issue that they have to take it up because they think it's crucial for institutional reasons to be able to protect the president under the Westfall Act. But we'll have to see how they analyze it. But you're right that typically the appellate lawyers analyze whether or not the facts of a particular case are so unappealing that if you use it as a vehicle to vindicate a particular legal issue, you're going to wind up setting bad precedent.
Finally, let's talk about Michael Avenatti, who is suing Fox News for defamation. He says they destroyed his reputation by reporting on domestic abuse allegations against him in 2018. So I have three bullet points written under this in my notes. They say actual malice, timeliness, and damages. And so these are three problems with Michael Avenatti suing over defamation that happened to him 2 years ago, he alleges.
Yes, this comes out of an incident during the nation's honeymoon period with Michael Avenatti, when he was still appearing regularly on the news and before he was indicted in three separate federal indictments. And what he claims is that at the urging of Jacob Wall, our favorite youthful criminous idiot, Fox News reported falsely the circumstances of Michael Avenatti's arrest in Los Angeles, falsely claiming that it had been him hitting an ex-wife and that there had been injury and that he had behaved in bad ways and things like that.
I'm sorry, was it an ex-wife? I thought it was his girlfriend.
Well, the false reporting asserted that it was his ex-wife.
Okay.
And it's apparently uncontroversial that it was not, in fact, his ex-wife. At any rate, he's alleging that the whole Fox crew went nuts with this, and they did, and that it was false. There are a couple of issues with this, Josh. One is that it's going to be, I think, very difficult for him to show actual malice, that they knew this stuff was false when it was being widely reported and when people were giving them this information. But the bigger issue is one of how do you prove damages against Michael Avenatti's reputation? The complaint very carefully describes Avenatti's storied past and his status at that point as a credible to stupid people possible presidential candidate. And then in describing his reputation, stops dead at the type at the time of the alleged defamation. So this is kind of like, Josh, if you slapped me across the face and then I got hit by a freight train. And then I sued you for the harm from being slapped in the face. Because Michael Avenatti's reputation was immediately completely blown apart by being charged with crimes and convicted in one of those cases, and all the associated bad press with that. So it fails me how he can prove that this particular set of things that Fox said are what damaged his reputation that led to any ongoing harm. It would not surprise me if Fox got it wrong. It would not even completely surprise me if they got it wrong recklessly. But Michael Avenatti may be the mythical defamation-proof plaintiff, the person whose reputation is so terrible that as a matter of law, it cannot be harmed.
There's also, don't you normally have to sue within a year for defamation?
Well, that depends on the jurisdiction. So many states, including New York and California, have a one-year statute of limitations. He sued in Delaware, and there's some question as to whether or not New York law actually applies to the claims, and therefore they fail on that basis. Another thing about Delaware is it does not have a good anti-slap statute. New York has a brand spanking new, very good anti-slap statute that everyone's just aching to take out for a test drive. So I think part of this suit is going to be choice of law issues. And everyone knows our listeners love choice of law and jurisdictional issues, Josh. So I'm looking forward to discussing that.
Very exciting. There's much more for us to talk about, but I think those choice of law issues are a good place to leave it. Ken White, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Josh.
If you have questions about the president's lawyers and his legal issues, please send them to us. You can find us on Twitter at LRCKCRW. You can also leave us voicemail at 424-538-8888. All the President's Lawyers is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Our production fellow is Victoria Alejandro. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and Ken and I will be back next week with more All the President's Lawyers.